Straight Shooter with Stephen A.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to this latest edition of Straight Shooter with yours truly, Stephen A. Smith. You know, this don't have much to do with politics on this particular show. I just finished watching all four episodes of a four-part Netflix docuseries, Sean Combs, The Reckoning. Damn. It's a lot, y'all. It's a lot. You know, we saw the footage of Diddy with Cassie and what he did and how folks were never going to get over that, and that would serve to taint his reputation forever. We played the video for you on this show where he came across as contrite on social media saying he was in a real messed up place at that time of that video. But then we hear some details from the trial about his behavior and stuff like that. And then after that, this docuseries that 50 Cent has been promising us for the last couple of years ultimately comes out. It's number one on Netflix, which, by the way, is streamed in 180 to 190 countries throughout the world. Several revelations in the four-part docuseries. Diddy's jealousy of Tupac and Biggie's relationship. Allegations that Diddy had Tupac killed. Suge Knight was the bodyguard for Al B. Sure, so the relationship with Diddy went back years. The East Coast, West Coast beef, how it started with the shooting of a Suge associate. Craig Mack was preparing to leave Bad Boy for death row and what subsequently happened with him. Biggie was also preparing to leave Bad Boy. Biggie, it was planning on going across the ocean, whether it was to England or somewhere else. And then the next thing you know, Diddy had insisted on him staying in L.A. because it was a party that night that he wanted Biggie to show up to. And it happened to be the same night that Biggie got shot in 1997, just 6 months after Tupac got shot. Allegations of sexual assault towards both men and women. Damn. That's just my perspective. I'm talking about what I saw on the docuseries. Few better to sit down and talk with about this, some of the details, than the actual person who directed the docuseries. She's an award winner. She's got credentials. And she's got a big time name most of y'all are never going to forget from now on. Her name is Alexandria Stapleton. She's up next, right here on Straight Shooter with yours truly, to talk about Sean Combs, The Reckoning, and a lot more details. Don't go away. Won't want to miss this. My guest is an Emmy Award-winning director and executive producer, along with Curtis 50 Cent Jackson, of the compelling four-part Netflix docuseries, Sean Combs, The Reckoning, about the disgraced mogul convicted of trafficking individuals for prostitution and now serving a 50-month prison sentence. Please welcome to the show, director extraordinaire herself, the one and only Alexandria Stapleton. How are you, Alex? How's everything going?
Good. Thank you for having me.
I'm doing all right. Are you comfortable, Alexandria? Alex, what you want? I mean, we going to bow down to you, Miss Number One on Netflix. How would you prefer you to be referenced, Alexandria or Alex?
Alex is totally fine. I just like Alexandria on my credit so people know that I'm a woman.
Well, absolutely. It's right there. Everybody can see it as plain as day. First of all, congratulations. How do you feel about this being number one on Netflix? I only ask that question from the standpoint of, was it an expectation or was it a hope?
I was not expecting it to have the amount of success that it's had so quickly. 50 kept telling me, you know, to be prepared for it to go to number one. He's been teasing me that he was right. But I just, you know, as a documentarian, you work so hard. This has been 2 years of my life dedicated with a very big team behind me. And so we're just, you know, it's an honor that so many people are watching and having conversations about it. So
how did you become involved with the project?
Well, you know, I was turned on to the story, I think, like everyone, when Cassie filed her lawsuit. And that was a very big public, you know, bomb that went off. And then so for me as a journalist and as a documentarian, I was very intrigued. And I had been working, I was already in a working relationship with 50. We have projects that we were developing at that time. And so then, you know, we had a conversation about collaborating and coming together to start putting the series together.
You know, so many people are looking at this. And I think one of the things that was fascinating about it, Alexandria, from the very, very beginning, when you saw Sean Diddy Combs, you expected a docuseries, you know, 50 Cent, he's coming, make no mistake about it. And so, you know, it's going to be riveting. That's just how he rolls. And obviously your work has been exceptional for years. And a lot of people need to know more about you and the phenomenal work that you've been doing. But to start off the docuseries with footage of Diddy, Sean Combs in his hotel room, 6 days before he was arrested I think threw everybody off, because nobody, obviously he wasn't going to cooperate with this, and nobody expected that. So the biggest question everybody's asking, how the hell y'all get a hold of that footage?
Well, I wish I could say more, but all I can say at this time is that it was obtained legally. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started working on the project, I will say this, I didn't know that that was going to happen, that I was going to, get that footage. So when I reviewed it for the first time, I remember thinking, okay, you know, this is kind of like something that we can use to weave throughout the story. And it, you know, it was jaw-dropping to watch for the very first time when, you know, we were going through the footage.
As a documentarian, having the eye that you have, engaging in the specifications that you do, what was shocking about that footage to you? I'm not talking about to the viewer. I'm not even talking about the 50. I'm talking about to you. What did you see that you thought would be so riveting to the public?
You know, I think it hits on a few different levels. First of all, you know, I think people forget that Sean Combs is a reality star. You know, he was a reality star for over a decade. So, and this is a man that has, you know, from all my accounts, he's been filming himself since the 90s. And so it was really surreal to be able to see and to watch him in these moments. And in my head, I'm like, well, what part of this is him kind of performing for the camera, or, you know, directing himself? What parts of this are that he's forgotten that the camera's even there? And it feels like, oh, this feels like, you know, a real part of his personality. And I think finding, you know, that being on that ride and that journey with and watching it was really intriguing to me.
You know, I'm looking at this right now and looking at it and seeing how intriguing it was. Do you believe that it served to incriminate him even more, or did it garner some level of sympathy purely for the level of desperation he appeared to be exhibiting while he was talking to his lawyers? By the way, you're not talking to somebody that's just reading some research. I watched all four episodes. I saw it. You know, I watched it from start to finish. So I'm asking you these questions, not just as somebody that's a journalist, somebody that's interviewed many people over the course of my career, but I'm asking you this question as a viewer, as somebody that was interested in seeing this subject through. I'm just wondering about that. Do you believe it served to incriminate him or let him off in some way in terms of garnering sympathy because of the level of desperation he was exhibiting on those tapes?
I really think it's a mixed bag. You know, I don't think it's, I think there's a lot of nuances in that footage. I don't think it's as black and white as maybe some people are seeing it. Okay. For me, I think, you know, for him to be such a major powerful figure, you know, a household name all over the world, and to have footage of like what he chose to do with these days, you know, while he knew he was under investigation. I think, you know, some of the choices of like going to Harlem and the public appearances, kind of like, you know, I thought even his kids, you know, being around him, seeing, you know, the people that were around him during that time period, it was all really fascinating. And then there's things about his personality that I also found, you know, to be interesting, like going to Harlem and having someone chase him in a hallway to put a necklace, you know, a chain on his neck, and not even stopping for that. I think you got little moments of kind of understanding the context of who Sean Combs is, you know, behind closed doors. And I think that made it a very unique viewing.
Did you believe that footage of him for the few days before he was arrested? Do you think it hurt him or helped him?
I think that it probably unmasked, you know, a bit more about him. I think that he is really savvy when it comes to controlling his narrative. And when we have him saying that in the film, and this is a person who really knows how to play a role with the media. And so I guess if you want to say if it hurt him, I don't know if it hurt his reputation. I mean, the Cassie tape has already come out. I mean, I think we've seen footage of, you know, actual abuse, which is, that's deplorable, you know, to see that type of behavior. So this is, again, I know maybe you're looking for like a yes or no or a answer, but I think it's just nuanced. It's really just getting a preview into who he really is, and where his priorities, you know, were in those last few days leading up to the indictment, and how he chose to conduct himself. And I think the question, you know, I made this film more about trying to get the American public to have a conversation about us. It's really a reflection about what do we tolerate and what do we put up with, you know, when it comes to people with a lot of fame and power. So, you know, I don't have the perfect answer for you.
That was a perfect answer. The perfect answer is whatever it is that you truly, truly feel. That's it. It's just that simple. We're talking to the wonderful Alexandria Stapleton right here with Stephen A., yours truly, on the Stephen A. Smith Show. Eric Sermon, EPMD. Kirk Burrows, co-founder of Bad Boys. Aubrey O'Day, Al B. Shore. Greg Kading, a retired LAPD cop. D1, former Mansfield Crips member. William Lassane, cousin of Tupac Shakur. Derek Parker, NYPD, had painted on his beard, by the way. Mark Curry, former Bad Boy artist. Roxanne Johnson, ex-wife of Craig Mack. Katana Harper, Diddy, Dirty Money member. Clayton Howard, Brooklyn Babs, member of 26. Joy Dickerson Neal, obviously, sexual assault accuser. Capricorn Black, former assistant Bad Boy. Jurors number 75 and 160 from the trial. As a documentarian, when we all of those people are incredibly, incredibly important, who stood out most to you?
Oh, wow. I feel like it kind of depends on what era, you know, what version of Sean Combs we were talking about. You know, the film is told in chronological order pretty much. And so each decade, you know, we kind of get a new version of Sean. And so, but I would say for throughout the whole series, Kirk Burrows, Tim Dog, you know, one of his earliest friends, I think they are kind of along with you for the entire ride of the show. And I think Kirk, especially, it was really interesting to interview him because he's been through a lot. And out of everyone that I sat down with, I feel like he became kind of the natural sort of narrator of the show because he was so peaceful. He was so like at peace with what, you know, the pain and the suffering that I feel like he felt that he endured from his time working at Bad Boy, and then in his opinion being erased, you know, completely from the story and from the narrative. But it was really amazing to be able to speak with someone who didn't speak with a lot of hate or a lot of like venom, you know, who was just very calm and centered in delivering, you know, his perspective on his life and his relationship with Sean.
Alexandria, you talked about what you wanted folks to get out of, what attention you want brought to this docuseries, and what you wanted people to really, really think about when they were watching this. What did 50 Cent tell you he wanted as you started this project?
You know, the very first conversation, and the reason we knew that we could, that we were good partners and collaborating to make this, was really rooted in getting into the nuance of the line of victim, the line of perpetrator, the lines, how, you know, stories are like this are really very nuanced and live in the gray, you know? And I think that as a public, we really crave, maybe because of social media, you know, I don't know, but we really crave these two-dimensional, very black and white answers to everything. And if you really want to look underneath the hood of the life of Sean Combs, there's a lot of gray. There's a lot of context that was never really afforded to him, you know, in the telling of his story. And those were all things that were really important to 50 to put into this.
Did 50 articulate to you the personal feelings he had about Sean Diddy Combs before this began?
No, it we never had a conversation ever about anything that exists on Instagram or any past, you know, issues. I think 50's been very vocal that wasn't the goal of making it. And that was never anything that we talked about.
I want to get to another question as well, because the doc also discusses the people in Diddy's orbit who ended up dead or in jail. Andre Harrell, Craig Mack, Kim Porter, Black Rob, to name a few. Is in this docuseries, I mean, it comes across like, at least in some people's eyes, like it was a connection to Diddy and their deaths. Was that intentional on you all's part to make that connection? Or were you just letting folks tell their story?
No, I mean, we were just letting folks tell their story, the fact, you know, the facts of people that have passed. I mean, those are just facts, you know. There was no board in the back of my office, like trying to thread that into the story. It is really wild, you know, that so many people that were a part of Uptown and Bad Boy, you know, either are not with us anymore, or, you know, left the business, or, you know, just had like very interesting endings. So it's just a natural part of telling the story.
Alexandria, you do know that when it comes to Tupac and Biggie, you know, nobody, everybody draws a connection to that. I mean, it came across like clearly there was some sort of connection. And then I thought it was incredibly damning. I mean, damn, Biggie dies and you don't even pay for the funeral. Biggie's, I mean, it's being paid through Biggie's dollars and whatever. I mean, people, I've over the last few days, I've heard people on the streets talking about that part just as much as anything else. I couldn't believe it. But that's what people are feeling right now. Was that intentional? Because a lot of people are looking at it as it's a clear connection between the deaths of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls in terms of Diddy having some level of involvement, although no one is aware of what specific involvement there was. It seemed like that was a message that was trying to be sent. Is it accurate to say that?
It's accurate to say that, you know, for the second episode, I really wanted to look into the East Coast, West Coast beef, you know, and that story. And I felt like after interviewing people that there was so much more that has never really, it never really gets discussed. And I also, you know, I felt like, first of all, there's a lot more to the story than just like the Source Awards and then Las Vegas and, you know, Biggie being murdered in Los Angeles. And so the first objective was like, let's go all the way back and try to understand the relationships that these these people have with each other. So like understanding that Suge Knight used to work at Uptown, that's where he cut his teeth in the music industry. He knew Sean Combs as an intern. They were friends or friendly with each other. You know, these were guys that, you know, went to Atlanta a lot and hung out, and there was a shoot, you know, there were all these other steps that never, ever, ever get discussed. I also felt like, you know, from Kirk Burrows' perspective and others, it was really interesting to bring to light more about how Sean felt he fit in between in the relationship between Biggie Smalls and Tupac. And I felt like that never really has, I mean, yes, if you're like really baked into all of the subject matter, I'm not showing you something that you didn't maybe already know, but for the, you know, for just a regular person coming to this story, I think that what's hitting is like people are very fascinated to understand the relationships that existed, you know, before all of the tragedy. And I think that that's important in order to give, to respect the tragic deaths of both of those people. They are human beings, you know, they were young men that no matter what, I mean, it's senseless violence and killing. And I think that I wanted to really humanize the story and to also understand Sean Combs's role according to Keefe D, because most of that story is really given to you through these tapes and police reports that we were able to, you know, to run in the film. This is Keefe D's account of what happened. And so people are running with that and coming up to their and drawing their own conclusions. And to me, it was also very important to include into the story, because it would be crazy to not talk about it when Keefe D is currently in jail and awaiting trial, which is going to happen next year in 2026, for, you know, the murder of Tupac. So the shooting of Tupac. So, you know, it felt like it would be like ignoring an elephant in the room to not go into that in as much detail as I could.
Another nugget that I noticed, and I wouldn't call most people wouldn't call it a nugget, but I will for the purposes of this interview, about how once Biggie had died, Bad Boy took off and it became significantly more profitable. Somebody as brilliant as yourself, I know that's not an accident. I mean, that's not there just for no reason. It's not there just as a nugget of information. It's there because it was a point being made. What was that point?
Well, you know, again, as a filmmaker, as a documentarian, I love like timelines, because it's not really my opinion. It's just mm-hmm. like, let me break down the facts and show you the timeline and to show you that, you know, so quickly after, you know, Biggie's tragic passing, you had things like Kirk Burrows, you know, being let go from the company. You had this really big moment, you know, on MTV's history, you know, with Sean performing with Sting and then him doing interviews, him releasing his album, and all of, you know, I think it was important for the viewer to see this paradox of how Sean presents himself in public with the media, and to compare and contrast that to some of the allegations that people who were willing to talk to us, you know, these allegations that they had and their truths and their story.
Let's go back to you and what your ultimate objective was, what you wanted attention brought to. Tell my audience what exactly that is.
You know, I think that in pop culture, being an American, we have it's very American in our culture to be obsessed with, you know, idols and people with a lot of money and a lot of fame and a lot of fortune. And, you know, Sean Combs built a giant ecosystem that does not really, it's not a complete true reflection of everything that was really going on in his personal life and in his work relationships and people that he was very close with. And I am just interested, and I wanted people to start having conversations about, you know, why do we allow ourselves to be swept away by the charisma of a public, you know, idol? And then when real allegations, you know, come forward and people are bringing things to life, it's really hard for an American, for the public to really be okay with that. And I think that for decades, these were all things that were rumored, you know, these are rumors and things that were, you know, people heard about this stuff, but then it was like swept underneath the rug. And I just felt like within the four episodes that I had, the 4 hours that I had, let me just present the story and try to get him to participate, try to get people to give a different perspective, to put it all together, to show like the kind of the pattern behavior of how he was allowed to just kind of do things that are not really nice or acceptable. And the fact that he was able to just kind of sweep it under the rug and reinvent himself and gain more power and more fame and more prestige. And that is very interesting to me as a filmmaker.
But whether it's looked upon this way or not, it certainly is looked upon this way by a lot of people. There were women who contributed to the sweeping under the rug part. In other words, they didn't come forward. And you highlighted that, whether it was Capricorn Clark who waited before she did it, or whether it was Aubrey O'Day, or whether, you know, how long it took for her to come forward. I don't think it was accidental that you pointed that out, adroitly so, and obviously professionally so. You did your job to the utmost, no question about that. But clearly, people are going to look at it and say, why didn't they say something? Why didn't they say something? Mm-hmm. And find a way to villainize those folks because they didn't come forward earlier. Not me. I got no problem. I understand what they were saying. But there are others that were watching that might come to that conclusion. How do you feel about that?
You know, it's been a very interesting thing that I've been noticing. And what I have to say to that is it's very easy to not be in Sean Combs's ecosystem and in his world. And from the outside looking in, to say, if that happened to me, I would have called the police, or I would have, you know, gone to the media and told all of his business, or, you know, or I just would have left that job. It's easier said, it's like hindsight is 2020, right? It's easier said than done. I think what I was trying to paint a picture of with the film was how complicated his world was once you enter it, and the carrot, you know, that was dangled, and it's not the carrot that was dangled was not always like fame. You know, for someone like Capricorn Clark, I think that she came to New York City and wanted the American dream just like everybody else, and was working for a billionaire and a very prestigious, you know, position. And when it didn't turn out to go the way when she was being put in, you know, some some situations that were uncomfortable for her, you know, perhaps even illegal at times, it's not easy to just go, you know, screw you and I'm leaving. When you need to continue to work, you know, you need to continue to put food on the table for you or for your family. And that's what I'm saying. Like these are really complicated issues, complicated relationships. Mm-hmm. And when you say goodbye to Sean Combs, I think that what is very apparent is that that's not just leaving Sean Combs. That may be like, I'm blacklisted from the entire business. What I've done with my life for the past 10 years just goes down the tube. And so again, it's easy to watch the film maybe and to say, I wouldn't do that. But until you actually walk through those types of shoes, you know, I don't think that one could really understand.
Are you of the mindset that should be the same attitude everyone should have with Cassie, his ex-girlfriend, who we clearly saw being abused in a hotel hallway when he hit and kicked and all of that stuff? I think footage that he'll never recover from, because people will hold on to that for the rest of his life, no question. But there's also the flip side where there were relations with other men, and she would call them and she would invite them and she would engage in whatever she engaged in. How do you look at it when you describe Capricorn Clark or Aubrey O'Day or somebody else compared to the kind of things that people saw and heard of as it pertained to Cassie Ventura?
Well, I think we saw what happened. We saw that play out in the courts and a part of what you're talking about. And so there's, you know, how the legal system handles things. And then there's just, you know, like the public opinion about, you know, her her coming back, I guess, if that's the question, her coming back to the relationship after.
That's what the juror that you spoke to, that's what he was saying. She kept coming back. That's why I bring that up, because he said that that was something that assisted in them, you know, letting him off on the most major of charges.
Yeah, I think it's really complicated. And I think that, you know, in matters of abuse with men and women who are abused, again, it's not like a black and white situation. You know, it's not a, there's a lot of complexities into things like that. Their relationship was complex. You know, this is a girl who was a girl who became, you know, who then is now, you know, a mom of, I believe, who has three children. She was 19 when she enters, you know, Sean's orbit. She's an artist. She is promised, you know, she's given a record deal. She's exposed to things for the very first time. I think all of that is context for their story. I think that for the jurors, it didn't really hold, you know, as far as her being a victim based on the charges that were being presented to them. You know, one of the jurors that I interviewed, she said domestic abuse was not one of the charges. So as far as, you know, the matters of the case, it was a very complex situation. The jurors made up their mind about it and felt that he was not guilty of trafficking or forcing, women, the two women that were involved with the case of they weren't forced into it. So, you know, I don't think that that's an opinion that is very different from a lot of people in the public. I think that, you know, again, a part of this documentary is to force us into these uncomfortable conversations, to force us into thinking about our legal, our justice system, and do we do enough, you know, for victims? When we have trials like this, are prosecutors really equipped with explaining, you know, the complexities of abuse to jurors and to people to get them to understand, you know, both perspectives?
We didn't see Cassie speaking in the docuseries. We didn't see her. We saw a lot of footage. We saw footage of her. We saw pictures of her. We didn't see her speaking to y'all. She didn't sit down with you. Why is that? Did you attempt to? And she said no. Did a lawyer say no? Why didn't that happen?
She did not want to participate. So she did. She said no. You know, there were multiple attempts to interview a number of people. You know, that's another kind of thing that's running around on the internet right now, is like, I want to see this person. Why didn't they have this person? And it's like, whatever person anyone is talking about, you can probably just trust that contact was made. Okay. We either didn't hear back from them, or, you know, sometimes we talk to people off camera and they just didn't want to sit down for an interview. So it wasn't for a lack of trying.
Based on the people that you didn't speak to, did they not want to speak to you because the reasons were they just wanted this to go away? They just wanted to move on with their life, or they were petrified of P. Diddy? Mm-hmm.
All of the above. There were, you know, people were really afraid. I think it's important to remember when I started making this, there was no indictment. There were no charges. So, you know, there wasn't even, the tape hadn't even dropped from, you know, the Intercontinental Hotel. So people were really, really, really scared. I mean, they were so petrified that at times, you know, people were like, are you an op? You know, like, are you just gathering information to go give it to this person, you know, or to give, you know, to Sean? It was, people were very paranoid and very afraid. That started to kind of let up, you know, as, or especially when the indictment happened, I think people got more comfortable. And so we kind of had a lot of people come to the table, you know, during that time period or after the indictment. And then, you know, most people who did not want to talk at all, I think that they just, you know, wanted to go bury their head in the sand someplace and just, they just want to never, you know, just, they just want to, like, they don't ever want to talk about it ever again. The complicated part, though, is that, and I think we're going to start to see this, you know, potentially unfold, is again, it's not just about Sean. I mean, another thing about this series, and I wish I had more hours to dedicate to it, is like, you know, there's a lot of people in his orbit. There are a lot of people that saw things. And there's a lot of people that, you know, it like I've that were victims in some stories and then were victimizing, you know, in other stories. And so I think that that's also kind of a fascinating part of this saga is, you know, yes, Sean is one person, but he designed an ecosystem and he also came from an ecosystem that he did not build, you know, and learned things and I'm sure, and was taught, you know, things by others. And so there's a lot more to this, to this story than just Sean Combs, but for the mission that I had and at the time that I had in only 4 hours, this is where we landed.
Alexandra, this is airing in approximately 180 to 190 countries. So I'd like to know, have you gotten any streaming numbers based on it being number one on Netflix?
Just what the public has seen. Yeah, I kind of like, I don't even like to think about that kind of stuff.
Why not?
You know, I'm really proud of the work that this team, you know, did, and it's the amazing editors and producers that I had on this project to bring this to life. And so I'm happy that, again, like I said earlier, that our work is being seen. I number one on the biggest platform, you know, the biggest streamer in the world is, you know, I guess it's a big deal. I just hope that people, the takeaway, the conversations, you know, are trend into like positivity versus just getting into the, you know.
Define positivity though, Alexandria. When you say you hope that that's what's going to happen as it gets towards positivity, define positivity in your eyes based on this project so everybody will know what that means to you.
Positivity is like being able to hold people accountable for bad behavior. Positivity is, you know, men and women being able to talk about being victims of sexual assault, and especially, you know, for men in our community to be able to talk about that without feeling like they have to hide it out of shame and embarrassment. Positivity is our people, you know, the public really like leaning into understanding how our courts are designed, you know, to deal with victims. Positivity is, you know, having a conversation about when things like this happen to people. You know, Sean Combs contributed a lot to the culture, right? Like, and I tried to also shine a light on that. What do you do when you have someone who's done heroic things in that space, but that, you know, has all of these allegations, or, you know, the public has seen, you know, that he's been abusive, you know, to his girlfriend, and to see a tape like that, how do you distill the good from him and the bad? I mean, it's like, these are all things that I wish that we could be talking about instead of, you know, sometimes getting dragged into, you know, the kind of like the social media, yep, you know, pieces of it.
More of this world to expose, in your estimation, is just at the tip of the iceberg?
I am very tired. There's nothing happening right now. But I do feel that this is the beginning of a lot more that will continue to come out. Like I said before, you know, KFED's trial is next August, I believe. And I think that's going to be very interesting to see. And you know, Sean has like over 100 civil lawsuits that he also has to deal with. And I think that's going to be very interesting to see how all of that unfolds. So in a way, you know, while the criminal trial that we all saw, or not that we all saw, but that we were all following, while that has come to an end, I think that this is kind of a new chapter and a new beginning for a lot more in this space.
One would imagine that you're insulated to a strong degree, but nevertheless, there's been indications that he's going to try to, Sean Diddy Combs, is going to try to sue Netflix. Who knows whether or not he'll come after 50, even though 50 ain't scared. And obviously, you know, you doing what you're doing, the marvelous work that you've done, who knows if somebody will say that he's going to try, you know, him or people he knows or whatever are going to try to come and deal with you, assuming it's in a legal fashion. I'm going to assume that because I don't want to paint an ugly picture. Any concerns that you have at all? Or is this project's over and done with you like this? I did my job. You guys go ahead and do what you got to do. I did my job. It's time for me to move on with my life. Where are you with all of this right now?
You know, as far as being concerned about things, I cannot pretend to know what Sean is going to do or what he's not going to do when it comes to legal proceedings. But I do know that we were very buttoned up. I, you know, have an amazing partner in Netflix. And I think that we brought forward, you know, we were very legally sound. And that was very important to us in putting this film out. So that's where I stand today.
Before I let you go on out of here, my last question, you've got two upcoming projects. Let's not forget that. You've got Prime Video documentary on NFL Hall of Fame wide receiver, the one and only Terrell Owens. And, of course, mm-hmm. the Brittany Griner story that premieres at the Sundance Film Festival in January. Want to talk about that for a quick second, just to let everybody know what you've got coming down the pike, because they need to know a lot more about the work that you have been doing, because it has been special.
Thank you. Now I'm trying to celebrate the Brittany Griner, the documentary right. there with, you know, her time spent in Russia with
right.
a whole geopolitical story behind that one that got into Sundance. And I'm really excited. And but we haven't had a lot of time to celebrate because we're trying to prepare for that. That's, you know, next month. But I'm really honored to bring this story out. But she's a fellow Houstonian, so I'm always trying to rep my city.
Right.
And then T.O. is going to be amazing. I would love to maybe get you in the chair to interview.
I told them, Alexandria, is that, you know, T.O. and I have had, you know, our back and forth and stuff like that. I said I would participate if he called me directly to ask. I didn't want anybody else calling me. And then I open my mouth and then he goes and complains about me opening my mouth when I'm not trying to bother the man. Had he called me and asked me to sit down for the documentary, I would have done it. That was my only request. Just so you know.
Copy that. Well, we're not done filming, so copy that, and we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I doubt he'll call, but if he called and asked me to do it, I would do it.
Cool. Well, that would be very cool if that can happen.
Last question for you. Congratulations on the marvelous work. Congratulations on the marvelous career that you've had thus far. I'm the award winner, and you've been nominated for numerous other awards. You're something special. I got to ask you, with this particular project, what do you think, what do you hope it will do for your future?
Well, for my future? Yeah. You know, I have a 9-year-old son, and I just I like to create conversations with my work, and I want my son to grow up in a world where he can be a man and understand how to treat people, how to understand how to treat women, I think, like, I'm just trying to create films to prompt change and to get people more comfortable with the uncomfortable conversations that sometimes we don't like to have. And so I do everything, you know, I do everything for my kid.
Absolutely. And you do it for a lot more people, even if it's unintentional. You do a lot, and it's a lot of good. Congratulations on this marvelous docuseries, The Reckoning. You did a marvelous job. All the best to you. Continued success in your enormous future, because you got one coming your way. It's something special. Congratulations. I'm happy to introduce you to my audience. Not that they didn't know you, but they'll know you now. Make no mistake about it. All the best to you moving forward, and I look forward to meeting you in person someday down the line. You take care of yourself, all right?
Thank you so much.
All right. One and only, Alexandria Stapleton, director extraordinaire, The Reckoning, Sean Diddy Combs. She did a great job. Make no mistake about it. Must see from start to finish. all 4 hour long episodes. Must see from start to finish. Back with more Stephen A. Smith Show, Straight Shooter, in a minute. Welcome back, Straight Shooter with yours truly, the special edition of it. Thanks again to the marvelous Alexandria Stapleton, who directed Sean Combs, The Reckoning, did an absolutely marvelous job. Again, it's number one on Netflix, which is streaming anywhere to 180 to 190 countries throughout the world. So to be number one on Netflix is a big damn deal. She did her thing. 50 Cent, the executive producer, did his thing. And needless to say, before we end this, somebody else wants to do their thing because they always got something to say about stuff like this. Nephew Josh is in the house. What's going on, man?
What's going on, man? I've been busy with these watch parties, but this documentary is something else, ain't it?
Yeah, it is, man. And, you know, you're sitting up here roaming around, coming into your uncle's studio, bothering me as usual, and thinking you deserve half my money. And then on top of it all, you were sitting in the control room listening to this interview with Alexandria Stapleton. Your thoughts about the docuseries and anything that she had to say during the interview that I just had with her?
I mean, my thoughts on the doc, it scares me a little bit. Because when you have, like, an uncle like you, and we always, it seems like we always going through, and I say we because, you know, I'm in your corner. Mm-hmm. We always going through, like, these Me Too type moments. Mm-hmm. And it's like, a lot of the stuff in the documentary is like, I got a lot of questions about it still.
Sure.
And, like, Kirk Burrows, for example.
Okay.
It's like, why are you ready to tell your story now? The timing is like, real funny to me. And, like, he's in jail paying for what he did. And now everybody wants to come with their truth.
You're talking about P. Diddy in jail paying for what he did.
Right.
Some people don't feel he's paying enough. He's only got, like, 4 years and 12 months time served. So it's really, like, 38 months left.
I mean, well, if you watch the trial, a lot of what he was up for, they deemed him innocent. So it's like you in there for domestic violence at the end of the day. So, you know, I feel like the time it suffices.
So what's your problem with Kirk, though? I mean, because this was a 25% owner of Bad Boys, mm-hmm. who obviously didn't get his stake. He mm-hmm. says that he was abused, both physically and emotionally. That's what he said. And he clearly didn't want to walk away with 25% of Bad Boys. I mean, he helped jumpstart it. I mean, he was a significant part of it. You would think that he could have gotten something that would have prevented him from experiencing homelessness, right. and struggling to make ends meet and all of that other stuff. What's your issue with him?
I just feel like the documentary kind of sheds a light on men not being men. Because even with the stuff that was going on with Cassie, you hear them saying, I heard her getting beat behind the door. Open the door and stop it. Or him, for example, they come to you with a bat for 25% of everything that you've ever worked for. I don't think I'll let that ride like that. And I'm not saying that he should be like me. I'm just questioning the men back then.
Okay, so what would you have done? Would you have, obviously you ain't gonna get hit by bats in a moment, but what would you have done?
I think, like.
Well, what do you think he should have done would have been a better question.
And I just feel like, you know, 50 Cent, for example. You know, we're from the same area. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I can't see somebody coming at 50 Cent's office, bad or not. Like, yeah, give me 25% of everything. I'll take care of it after. We'll take care of it later. It's not happening like that. And it's because he's of the man that I'm talking about, and I feel like I am, I feel like you are. I don't think that goes down like that with real men. If you hear women getting beat behind the door, right. You're going to stay in front
Hell
of the
no.
door? Of course we not. So that's just what I'm talking about, and he's very talkative. That's why I'm on him like that. Mm-hmm. He's very talkative, and it's like, why now? You could have stopped stuff. You was in a position of power, maybe not as powerful as Diddy, but you still had a responsibility.
Who was the brother that used to that worked for him that was like producing records and you know, he said that he was abused by Diddy as well. And but he also said that he was there when Diddy and son Justin went in the bathroom and you heard pow pow, two shots. Yeah. And then the next thing you know, they walked out. He walked in the bathroom and the cat was bleeding out and they had to, you know, get him out of there. I'm like, so somebody just shot him. Like, your thoughts about that?
That's what I'm trying to say. It's like nothing's really adding up. And if the events are true, it's like the people that are there are just as bad as Diddy. And I feel like them being outside telling the story, nah, y'all should be paying for what for not doing nothing at all.
I'm going to transition to the women.
Right.
And I'm going to preface this by asking you to be very, very thoughtful. Right. You understand? Because you know how you can get sometimes.
Yeah, it's a funny you understand? Time, so
I would ask you to mind you, to be careful, okay?
Yeah,
there's Cassie. There's Capricorn Clark. Mm-hmm. You know, the ex, you know, not she wasn't an ex of Diddy's, but she worked for him. She was like essentially his chief, you know, his chief marketing person, his chief of staff almost. I mean, that's what I don't know what to name her, but you've got that going on. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was an ex that also claims that she was abused, obviously so, and there's civil lawsuits against Diddy, no doubt about it. Aubrey O'Day, she's spoken out as well. Your thoughts about what the ladies had to say and about the evidence that has clearly come out against Diddy?
So I follow the trial, because I'm just invested, because I feel like I this is my era. And I watched it, and when you listen to Cassie talk or you hear the Cassie stories, it's like everything don't scream victim. I know what happened. I know we've seen the videos and everything, but there's also things of her sending text messages like, oh, I'm going to kill you.
So,
oh, this would happen.
Well, so basically, because I want to be careful now. Yeah. Now, the jury, I'll come to your defense on this one in this regard.
Okay.
The jury, basically, the one juror basically said that's one of the reasons, you know, they didn't come with the heftier charges that she kept going back. She kept going back. She didn't understand that. Obviously, Alexandria Stapleton and many, many women out there are saying it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. You're not in their shoes. We're not in their shoes. We're not women. So we get that part. We got to be thoughtful in that regard. But in the end, it is fair to say that clearly the jury was somewhat apprehensive mm-hmm. about some of the things Cassie Ventura was claiming. Otherwise, Diddy would have had far stiffer penalties exacted against him.
Did it. So that was another thing I had a problem with too. Like all of a sudden, and not to get back to that guy, but he's the one that said it. He said, now in my mature age, I feel like Sean had something to do with Pac's murder. You were there. And that's what I'm trying to say. Like, why now? 25, 30 years later? And it's just like nobody's really calling him out. And it's because he's coming out as a victim, but like I said, Diddy, you can't do all that stuff by yourself. When you behind the door and stuff like that, somebody's in front of the door. When a girl's bleeding, she ran to somebody to get cleaned up. Like, everybody should be held responsible. That's just how I feel about it.
What do you think should happen to Diddy going forward? Get out of jail and just go on with his life? I mean, if he tries to come back in the music industry, you know, people gonna buy his music, think people should buy his music. What's your mentality about it moving forward?
I mean, we still listen to R. Kelly. Talent,
but he's in jail though. But he's in jail.
Oh, you mean he's doing 30? He's doing 30.
So it don't mind. I wouldn't buy R. Kelly stuff after I saw the stuff that he was doing when he was out of jail. But when he's in jail, it doesn't bother me as much because he's doing 30 years.
Said I know. Yeah. You just said we're not gonna be talking on stuff. I'm not talking on certain people and nothing like that. I got a future.
Your voice didn't sound that bad, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It sounded a little bit like R. Kelly.
Don't do that either. Don't do that. Don't say I sound like R. Kelly.
Well, I'm just saying. You just did. You just tried to imitate him.
I mean, I got a Christmas song out. You heard it? Yeah.
You got a Christmas song out?
I got a Christmas song out. We're going to do like a special Christmas episode, though. I ain't going to drop it yet. But yeah, Christmas.
You know what's really bad?
What's
up? When your mother calls me to tell me how much you could sing.
That's what I'm saying. You missing it.
But you don't ever give your mother big ups on this show. You don't ever give Arlene Smith, your mama, big ups. You always come on talking about you. You always talk about you, the culture. Mm-hmm. You always talk about this other stuff and how we rich. You always do all of that stuff. But you never talk about the queen, your queen, who should be Arlene Smith, your mama.
Right.
My sister.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you brought her up, you want to know how she really feels?
How she really feels.
Well, she said when I was a baby, and this is why I feel like I'm entitled to have. I'm going to tell y'all right now.
Oh, my God.
She said when I was a baby, you was in college. Is that true? In 1989, 90, were you in college?
88, yeah. 88.
Right. So in the book, you say you was living off of tuna and Kool-Aid.
That was. Absolutely.
Now, tuna and Kool-Aid still cost money that you didn't have. So my mother said she was working and was giving him like 7 to 10% of her check at the time,
That's a lie. That's a lie.
My mother's lying?
First of all, yes. If you, if that's what you say, if what she said, what she said. See, she's my sister. Yeah. You have to worry about it. I don't have to, I can argue with my sister. You understand what I'm saying? My point to you is your mother sent me like $20 a week for tuna, fish, and Kool-Aid. $20 a week is not 10% of her money.
In 89?
In 89. It was not. Stop it.
Well, whatever percentage it was, give it her the same percentage.
It wasn't even 1%. So that's not an argument.
Give her the same percentage out of the 100 million, and we'll be fine.
Okay, so I give you 0.0001%.
How much is that?
That's 20.
That's still like 100,000.
No,
so you could,
no, that might be what I pay you now. You understand what I'm saying?
Why are you exposing my salary to the girls? That's
showing that you earned your money. Don't you want them to know that you earn in a living as opposed to just having your hand out for your
own
money?
I don't want them to know nothing because I owe a couple of them. Somebody bought me this. How lit? New watch. My birthday was the other day, too. I ain't even going to act like he ain't give me nothing. You just blessed me. I appreciate him. You know what I'm saying? So y'all stay off of him, too. You've been fighting back, though. I give you that. You've been fighting back. This time, I told him to relax on the last. You know, leave the ladies alone. It's NBA season. We about to have a few plays upset at us. You gonna come to my watch party?
Wait, why are you having watch parties?
Cause like, look, cause I talk about the game, and the girls be there too, so they come get dating advice from me right there.
They get dating advice from you?
Yeah.
You give dating advice?
Yeah.
I'm out. That's it for this edition of the show.
Who dates more than me? Why I can't give advice?
Excuse me. Don't do that. Right, don't do that. Right, don't do that. You see how you do? You see how you do? Somebody at home, bro, loving you, man. That's bad. That's bad. Let's just go. Because he's just going to get in more trouble. The show's over, all right? I talk to y'all next week. Let's go. Let's go. I'll do this for you.
Peace signs up. Yeah.
All right? I do that. You happy? I did it, okay? Get out of here.